All right, here we are, another episode of Synaptic. Welcome, thanks for joining. This is our show that looks at the people, the research, and the challenges of the neuroscience space. And this is episode 15. My name is Brady Huggett, and I host the show. Okay, let's get to it. Today, let's go back to 1994, and let's go to Korea. That year, North Korea announced that its leader, Kim Il-sung, had died, reportedly, of a heart attack. His passing was momentous for both North and South Korea to consider. That year, there was also a deadly bridge collapse in Seoul, South Korea. Part of the Seongsu Bridge, which spans the River Han in Seoul, suddenly fell into the water, and 32 people died. There was also a heat wave that summer, with temperatures reaching higher than 33 degrees Celsius, or above 91 degrees Fahrenheit, for 29 straight days. Now, these things might sound like bad news, but Korea, by the 1990s, had been in a long recovery from the Korean War. And South Korea, in particular, was a country in ascent. Its poverty rate had steadily declined from 1965 through 1990. So now let's go to the southwestern part of Seoul, specifically the Guru, Yeongdong-po, and Yangcheong districts, because it was in that area, around 1994, that a young girl named Sohyung Kim went through a kind of metamorphosis. That's our guest for today, Sohyung Kim. Right before middle school, Sohyung and her family moved into a slightly better neighborhood, which meant she went to an improved school. And at that school, because Sohyung is a social person, she made a lot of friends and was voted class president. And because she was class president, she felt some pressure to fit into that role, as she said, and she suddenly began taking her classes more seriously. That's not to say she wasn't studying before. I mean, she was. But before that, she had mainly wanted to spend time with her friends. And now, because her friends were the ones excelling in school, she began to excel in school, too. And she began to seriously think about what she might want to do with her life, what she wanted to study, and where. We talked about that on this podcast. We also talked about one of her family members who had some mental health issues and how that is what drew her to study clinical psychology. And from there, she was led to autism. And we talked about what a life-changing experience it was to be mentored by Kathy Lord. And we talked about Sohyung's current work at Korea University. All of that coming up in the next hour or so. I interviewed Sohyung at her office on the campus of Korea University on June 21st, 2024. It was a very hot day in Seoul, sunny and a high of maybe 94 degrees Fahrenheit. I put the mics across from each other on a table in her office, and because it was warm, she plugged in a quiet fan to help move the air around, so you can hear a kind of soothing background hiss as we talked. I think you're set up, so let's start here, where I'm asking Sohyung about the Organization of Human Brain Mapping Conference that was held in Seoul June 23rd through the 27th. Here's your episode of Synaptic with Sohyung Kim, starting right now. So you don't go to OHBM?
No, this time I won't, and I haven't been to HBM, to be honest, because I don't do imaging studies, but I do EEG studies. So this time, because it's in Korea, I thought I would go, and we put a poster in, and we got it accepted, but my student is going.
Yeah, I was wondering, like, you know, how it felt to have that in your hometown like this.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I left Korea 15 years ago, and it was after I graduated from my bachelor, my college. And at that time, I was not connected to anyone in academia, so I didn't know if conferences were in Korea, but I bet there was nothing. But now that I came back, I've been here for 2 years, and I had so many friends from America come and visit. Because they had conferences here, and it's like people in California that I couldn't see for years, even if I was in New York. Mm-hmm. So I joke that, like, ever since I came here, I see more of my friends from America than ever before. So OHBM happening here is a big deal.
Yeah, I feel like that says something about Korea.
Yeah.
Or about maybe not only Korea, but Seoul. Like, Seoul has really risen as, like, a global city.
Yeah.
Now. Yeah. But were you born in Seoul?
I was born in Ulsan, which is close to Busan, which is south of Korea.
Did your parents grow up there?
No, my parents are from Seoul, but my dad was working in an oil company in Ulsan. And at that time I was born there. I lived in this community where all the employees of that company lived together. So it was a big apartment complex where we had our preschool. I went to school walking distance, maybe like 20 minutes or so. And I had to climb up like a little hill that was not paved to go to school.
Like through the forest?
It was kind of like woody. And I was very adventurous. I would leave home in the morning and would not come back home until like dinner time. Mm. No supervision whatsoever. And I was like five.
This company, this was a big oil company. Was it drilling or something, or what was it?
Yeah, it's called Sangyong. Mm. And now I don't know if they are still strong, so it was an oil company where...
What did your dad do? Was he an engineer?
He is an engineer.
Yeah, okay,
a chemical engineer, but he's now retired, but he now is in like more of a science teaching business, but he was an engineer.
So both your parents grew up in Seoul?
Yeah.
And he moved the family down there for this job. Mm-hmm. What did your mother do?
My mom was a nurse, but she quit her job when she got married, and then she was stay-home mom, and then she decided to go to a veterinarian school.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so she became a vet. But that was when I was like around 7 or 8. So she got into college again to study, and we moved to Seoul then.
Oh, okay. So she had the nursing degree, stopped nursing, had... How many do you have siblings? You do?
Yeah, I have a younger sister.
So two kids.
Yeah.
And then she said, I'm going back to school, got the veterinary degree, and became a vet.
Yes.
And the whole family moved to Seoul.
Yeah, because she got into the program. So we moved to Seoul when I was like 6 or 7.
And your dad kept the same for...
He stayed in Ulsan for like a year and then came to join us. And then he then was working for Hyundai.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Yeah, these are really... Hyundai's another international company. It's a really big company.
It's a big company.
So when you were living in Ulsan, the company was big enough to have provided a little like community.
Yeah.
With a school, probably a grocery store, those kinds of things. Yeah, yeah. And so do you know how your parents met?
They met in college. Yeah.
Yeah. No big story there.
Yeah.
They disbanded.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fell in love.
Yeah, and they got married.
In Seoul.
Yes, and then they moved to Ulsan because of my dad's job.
Yeah, and that's where you were born, actually. Okay.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, I'm not quite sure of the timeline, but so it wouldn't have been you or your parents, but your grandparents probably experienced the Korean War. Yeah?
Yeah. So my mom's side, so when we moved to Seoul, we actually lived with my mom's parents for a year or 2 years while my dad was finding his way to Seoul. And I got to live with them for a couple of years, which was a very, very interesting experience. My mom's parents are from North Korea. So after the war, they like blocked the border, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And they said, we'll have a break. And we've had that break for like 7 years. It's not like we are going to end the war. It was actually a break.
Yeah.
And during that time, during that period, a lot of people were like moving up and down
because the
border control was not like perfect. But it was dangerous to come across the border. But my grandparents, my mom's side, crossed the border with two kids, my mom's older brothers.
And her.
She was not born yet.
Okay.
They had five kids. They came across the border, and my grandma will always say this when they get into fight and say, your grandpa abandoned me when we were coming across the border. We were swimming, and then there were like soldiers coming, and your grandpa just like ran away thinking that they're gonna get arrested or something, but it was the South Korean soldiers coming to rescue them.
So as they were finishing the swim,
yes,
he saw soldiers and ran the other direction.
Yeah. Oh, he like, grandmother. And then my grandma's like holding two kids, the water's coming up, and the soldiers are like, come, like you're gonna get on the, you know, ship. And then they did. And then grandpa came after. He was like, okay, it looks safe. Oh, let me go and
what does he say? Join. When your grandmother would say that, what would he say?
He will not say anything, but he was not that embarrassed.
No. But so they had, so the crossings, there wasn't, like, you weren't allowed to cross, so they had to actually swim across the river?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, I thought for a while they had a little bit.
Secretly, somehow, because I think it was a year or 2 years after.
Yeah.
Do you
know why, I mean, why did they decide that they wanted to go to the South?
I don't know, actually. They got separated from their family members, so they had their parents, sister, brothers, cousins all in North Korea. So when my grandpa was dying, he would say things like, please let me call them. I need to like talk to them. And we would be like, you know, we cannot talk to them now. He was kind of losing it, but then at the same time they really missed their family and they couldn't see them anymore.
Yeah. So that's like my limited knowledge, right? So just tell me where I'm wrong. But that's, I read that again and again and again, how it tore families apart.
Yeah.
And you just had to, like a wall came down.
Yeah.
Almost like
without
a literal
knowing,
wall.
Yeah.
You don't know if they're okay. You can never communicate again. Yeah. But is that still the way? Like you can't, I guess you can't email.
No.
I mean, it is, that's brutal.
Yeah. I will have distant cousins maybe living there. My husband's grandparents are also from North Korea, so we do think about this topic quite a bit, and we really hope that someday we will be reunited.
Yeah.
But not everyone thinks that way.
Your father's parents, where were they?
They were from here,
so they're from
not
Seoul.
From North Korea, but during the war or before the war, my grandfather parents were in Japan for a while studying, and then they came back, and my dad grew up very poor, and he went to college, and he went to a really good college. He went to Yonsei, which is a big time rival of Korea University. And he really made his way for his entire life. Like, for example, he wouldn't have shoes to wear when he went to school during, like, you know, middle school. And he was so embarrassed.
What years were we talking about?
He was born in 1952.
Okay. So this is right. So he grew up exactly post-war.
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, everybody was poor then.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. But he was especially very poor. But he did it. He made his way.
Yeah. Okay. So you're growing up with all this history behind you, and what were the things that interested you as a kid? Were you interested?
When I was growing up, as I told you, I was big on just hanging out with friends and visiting them, and I would not come back home until dinner time. My mom will still talk about that, and that's a big deal for her because she thinks that I got here because she thinks that I wouldn't have gotten here if I continued to be like that, because there is huge emphasis on academics. She's like, she wouldn't study at all. I don't know how she got here now.
Here being Korean, like, University.
Yes. Yeah, and like
a PhD.
Getting a PhD and having this kind of career. She was not the type who would. Because I was not really interested in studying.
Like, so you were social.
I was very social. I'm still, I think, very social and chatty. I was really into comic books. So I read really a lot of comic books with my sister. And at that time, my mom was still studying, working, so we didn't have any supervision at home. So we will come home, like, eat ramen noodle and just read comic books. And I didn't study really hard until I think middle school, high school. But now Korean kids have so much academic pressure.
Yeah.
If you live like me, you wouldn't be able to make it.
Yeah. So what made the change for you in middle school where you thought, okay, now I'm going to study?
That's so interesting. I don't know. I mean, I was always in school districts that were not the most popular ones. Even though my dad was really made his way, like, we never lived in a rich neighborhood. So I moved to new school one day, and I think at that time, because I was social, I became like the classroom president.
Because people liked you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's this stereotypical, I think, way of thinking about, you know, presidents in classrooms or school president. I became a school president at some point, but that was way later. But and like, I had to kind of fit into that role. So I think I started studying, and then I got to hang out with friends who are doing well. And even if I didn't try really hard, I did quite well because I didn't live in the most competitive neighborhoods. I had really variety of friends who are very poor to like people who were well off, but not really well off. It was not like the best neighborhood, but I did well enough to be recognized by teachers.
Okay. You're saying the schools were okay.
Yeah.
They weren't the best schools, but they were okay. And so the people around you maybe, I don't know, weren't studying very hard. And so you weren't studying very hard.
Yeah.
You went to a new school, you became a president, president of the class, and then you felt this pressure almost.
Yeah, to study.
And then you were with people who were studying hard, and you said, well, I'm going to study hard too. Yeah.
Yeah. And but even in middle school, high school, I think in high school, because I also went to a high school that was not really a school where they send kids to best school, like best colleges. I was like the top in my whole, one of the top students in my whole class, but we never had like 10 kids going to Seoul National or Korea University or Yonsei.
Yeah.
So when I was studying really hard, I was the only one almost studying really hard. Nobody else was super interested in going to good colleges at the time. But by the time that I was in high school, I was really focused because during high school years, I met a teacher who recommended that I go study in America. His kid was in America studying in high school or something.
Oh, in high school he was
studying abroad. And he was like, you have so much potential. You can learn so much in America. Like, think about going to colleges there. And I brought it up with my parents, and they're like, we cannot afford it. You're going to college in Korea. And once you get there, you'll figure it out. And that was very crushing to me because I was like, America, new opportunities, amazing education. I need to go there. So I became like laser focused, and I said, I will go to college and I will figure out a way to go study abroad.
Okay.
From then on, I was really driven.
I wondered if at what stage, you know, I don't know if you had just thought, I'm going to go to the U.S. for this specific program. But in general, you're like, when I'm done with college, I'm going to go study abroad. You didn't even know what it was going
to
be.
Yeah, but I wanted to go to a college in America, but we just couldn't afford it.
Yeah. Okay, so then you go to, I'm probably going to pronounce this wrong.
Yuha?
Ihwa.
Yeah.
Ihwa Women's College here in Seoul.
Yep.
Yeah. Were you already thinking about clinical behavior, psychology at that time, or how did that come?
So in Korea, when kids go to college, they select their discipline based on their grade. So if you have the best grade, you'll go to medical school. That's what's happening now, right? So all the medical schools get filled with like the student who takes the SAT and get like 100% on it, and they fill in all the medical schools. And then from then on, like, the popular disciplines get filled based on the grades. Like, if you do well, you're going to aim for that. So that's very sad. Mm. But
so if you had the best grades and you wanted to be, I don't know, an English teacher,
that'll be very rare.
That's not with your grades. You should be a doctor.
Yes. Yeah, so that's how
a lawyer.
Yes. Okay. That's what's happening now. But when I was in high school, I got interested in psychology because my uncle had some issues mentally, and I saw that his whole family got, you know, affected by that. And I got super interested in clinical psychology, like how, and helping people who are struggling psychologically. And I read books about them, and I said I want to study psychology. So by the time that I was applying to college, I had my grade, right, for Korean SAT, which is the biggest deal. You know, you build up from elementary school to middle school to high school to take that test, and you have to get the best score ever, and you can only take it once a year. Mm-hmm. If you don't do well, you have to wait another year after graduating high school. So I took it. I didn't do, you know, as much as I wanted, but I got a decent score, so I looked at the, you know, the schools that I can apply and the departments, and Ewha Psychology would be easy for me to get in. And also I had psychology interest.
Yep.
And then other schools were like Yonsei English department, or really good school with a lower, you know, less popular discipline.
Like, I don't even know what that would
be. Yeah, I don't know. So I applied, and then I got into Ewha, and my dad was like, I think you could do better. Why don't you try for another year? And I was like, there's no way. I'm going to go to grad school in America, so I'm not going to delay that. I'm going to go to Ewha. Ewha was amazing. I mean, that's how I got here, but at that time, it's not like, you know, the Korean top three schools are Seoul National, Yonsei, and Korea. Yeah. So, but still, I mean, it opened up so many good opportunities for me.
Yeah. Okay. So you finished, what was your degree in?
Psychology.
Yeah. Okay. And as you're going through school, you're already looking at places to apply in the United States?
So I had never been outside of Korea until I was a second year in my college. So I taught English to myself during like middle school and high school because I was really interested in English. Uh-huh. I listened to tapes. Yeah. I listened to, at that time, Friends, the show. It was so popular. I would watch it and like just like say those lines.
Yeah.
And then as soon as I got into college, at Ewha, they had an exchange program. So I was like, this is the opportunity to go to college in America. So I applied for the exchange program. I went to Mount Holyoke at that time. But before then, after the first year, as soon as I was done with my first year, freshman in college, I told my parents, I need to learn English. I need to go to America and learn English. And they were like, we don't have money though. How are you gonna go? And suddenly my grandma, who is from North Korea, who like built her entire life up from nothing, said, I will give you some money so that you can go. At that time she sold her building or something that she had. It was like a little building where she had restaurants and
she had, once she'd established herself in South Korea with her, your grandfather, she had somehow bought a building and started businesses.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
She started from nothing. Yeah. They just swam with nothing. And then they came here, they had restaurant, they had like a little restaurant, and then it became a building. So
she sells that.
Yeah. She's like, I will give you some. And that was like just enough money for me to go to Delaware, and I went to University of Delaware English Language Institute, their like ESL program, and I was there for a year, and I did stay with like a stay home family, American family.
Yeah.
And I was there for a year learning English. And then
you'd go to a class every day.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And just learn English. And it's very diverse. Like people from all over the world come there to study English. So I was there for a year. Made a lot of friends.
After college?
No, first year of college, freshman. Oh. Oh, after freshman.
Okay, you did 1 year at...
I took a break.
Yeah,
and then after, took a break. Yeah, and then I went. And then I came back. So I'm about to start my sophomore year. And then that's when I met my husband too. But after the sophomore year, I said I will go to Mount Holyoke for exchange programs. So I applied, I got in. I was in Mount Holyoke for another year. So I did 2 years out of 5 years of college in America. Huh. So I made my way there. And I was able to go to the Mount Holyoke because it was an exchange program. I didn't have to pay the tuition for that rate.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
it cost you what it would normally cost you to go to.
Yeah. And at that time I had like scholarships. So it like literally costed nothing.
Great.
To be in America in amazing school. Mount Holyoke is just, I mean, it blew my mind off. yeah. And from Delaware to Mount Holyoke was also a very different environment too.
Okay. Yeah. So this is amazing. So you come back, you finish your undergraduate. You said it takes 5 years. And you go to Michigan after that, right?
Yes, I did.
Right. So how did that, you know, you have to apply, you have to know who you're going to study under for your PhD. How did all that come about?
So when I was at Mount Holyoke, I was dating my now husband, my boyfriend, who was at University of Michigan.
Okay. So you're at Mount Holyoke. He's at Michigan?
Yeah, so I met him before he went to Michigan.
You met him in Seoul?
Yeah, I met him in Seoul before I came. I went to Mount Holyoke in Seoul. He was about to go to University of Michigan. He got accepted and he was just waiting to go.
For his undergraduate?
Yeah,
yeah,
for his undergrad.
Got it.
So he's 3 years younger than me. Uh-huh. So I was just done with my freshman year in college. He graduated high school and was waiting to go to Michigan. At that time, we were in English class together at Yonsei.
That's how you met him?
Yes. Uh-huh. We met in a class. And then we started dating, and then he went to Michigan. So when I went to Mount Holyoke, I said, well, I have the summer vacation before I go home, so why don't I go and visit my boyfriend in Michigan? But then I want to be productive. So I emailed everyone in psych department at University of Michigan and said, I am a student from Korea University. I am nobody. But please, can I go and work in your lab? And of course, Kathy Lord emails me back and says, sure, come. And I went there and worked with Kathy. I mean, I saw Kathy probably like once, but she had a huge center, a UMAC, University of Michigan, Autism and the Developing Communication Disorder Center. Uh-huh. I was there for about 3 months, scoring protocols, doing data entry, and hanging out with my boyfriend.
Yeah.
And then I came back. And then I did another year or 2 years at Ewha, and then I applied to Michigan for grad school. But meanwhile, I got a scholarship, full scholarship from SK. Do you know that company, SK? That's a big company in Korea.
No.
They have SK Telecom. They have various big business in Korea, and they have this scholarship program for people who go abroad to study. So they give you tuitions, they give you stipends for 5 years. Huh. They cover everything.
Did you apply for that?
Yes, okay. I had to take a test, and then I had to take the interview. They select about 10 people for like social studies and others, and then probably like 20 in engineering and science. And I remember sitting in that room taking the exam, and there were like 500 people. And I was like, I'm from you know, I'm not from Seoul National, Korea, Yonsei, and the committee is probably people from there, and there's no way
I'm not going to get it
that I can make this. But somehow I was the only person not from Seoul National, Korea, or Yonsei who got in. And I made all the way there and got selected. So when I applied, I said, I have this scholarship. I'm coming with the money. So it was easier for me definitely to get in. And then there were other people at Michigan who had this fellowship already. So
oh,
really? They knew that oh. these students were going to be good.
Yeah.
So when I said I'm applying, they were like, sure.
But did Kathy know you were applying? Did you yes. apply through Kathy?
Yeah. No, actually, yes. Well, I mean, I did tell her when I was applying, but I applied to like 20 other schools. But when I was interviewing, I talked to Kathy directly, and at that time she was like, you'll be amazing, please come.
Yeah.
And she knew that I worked in her lab like
yeah.
a year or
she
2 years
that.
Ago. Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's funny that when you were sending emails around to the university, well, I don't know, but I mean, of course Kathy replied, right? That's the kind of person
yeah,
she is
yeah.
to do that.
Yes.
Yeah. So while you're there, you do a bunch of things, and she's kind of a mentor to you. I mean,
yep.
I keep reading that. You tell me if I'm wrong.
Yep.
But you worked on like OCEL together, the observation of
spontaneous the language
expressive
measure.
Language. Yeah, yeah.
And then I worked on like the ADI, the interview algorithm for
yep.
toddlers. I still work with her.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I have an NIH grant with her.
Yeah.
So she is my academic mom and a huge supporter
of your career.
Yeah, I mean it was just life-changing experience for me to meet her.
Yeah, so you kind of go in thinking I like the brain a little bit or what happens with people, but now when you're finished with your PhD, it's specifically autism.
Yeah
from that point on.
Yeah.
Okay, and I think then it's a postdoc at Yale, right?
Yeah, I did my postdoc at Kasia Havarska's lab at Yale for 2 years. I got licensed because I wanted to be licensed. I did internship at Michigan, and then I did 2 years postdoc years at Yale, and then I was a research scientist there for a year, and then I got recruited again at Cornell when Kathy was there as a director at CADB, the Autism Center.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then you moved to New York.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. And so where are you in your relationship at this point? With you and your husband?
Oh, yeah. So we got married when we were in Michigan because I was finishing up, and he graduated from college. He was a math major, and then he always wanted to go to med school. He applied. He didn't get in the first year. So what he did was he did master's in biostatistics, and he stayed in Michigan with me for 2 years. When I got a job at Yale, he got rejected at every medical school, so he just moved with me, and he was trying to figure out
what's next. Yeah.
Which was very brave for him. I wouldn't have been able to do that if I were him, but he did tag along and he came with me, and he did a variety of things. He was like working in a lab, and he again applied. But he only applied to a couple of schools in Connecticut because we wanted to be together.
Yeah.
And he got into medical school at UConn.
Yeah.
And during his medical school and during my postdoc years, we had David, our first child. Yeah.
So you're doing your postdoc, he's in medical school, and you have your first child.
That was wild.
How did you get all that done, the both of you?
It was very hard. I mean, and we didn't have any family support because... like, you know, my parents are in Korea. Dan's parents are in Korea, too. We just had to figure it out. And it was just a very brutal experience.
Brutal because there's not enough time in the day. You can't get enough sleep.
Yeah.
You know, you have to. You obviously want to spend time with your children. You're both really busy, all that.
Yeah.
But somehow you just do it.
Yeah, we did manage it. We had great childcare system there at Yale. But I still remember, like, feeling like I was not doing, I was not putting 100% in my work. Of course, that's what's gonna happen. Yeah. But that was hard. But the second child was much easier when I went to New York. I was not a postdoc. I had my own lab, so mm-hmm. I was more flexible. I remember holding Grace, my second child, after like a you know, a week or late, you know, after the labor, mm-hmm. and just writing papers.
I mean, did you feel like for a while there, you're like, I'm not putting 100% into work. I'm not putting 100% into the family because you can't.
Yep.
And you're just trying to keep both afloat.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I felt like I was faking it. And I still feel like it now. But I think I accepted the fact that I cannot put 100% on both.
Yeah.
In both. I cannot be a perfect mom. I cannot be a perfect researcher or clinician.
I mean, if you didn't, if you had no job, you still couldn't be a perfect
yes,
mom. What's a perfect
exactly.
mom? It's nothing.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, you learn that through the process, but it's not easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Dan felt the same, I'm sure. I mean,
yes. Yeah. Know. Yeah.
Geez. So, okay. So when you're at Weill Cornell, was he still in medical school?
He actually finished his medical school, did resident in New York. So he moved himself to New York.
Got it.
And he did his pediatric residency. And then he is a pediatric cardiologist. So he wanted to do fellowship in cardiology. So he did that for 3 years at Long Island Jewish Hospital. Hmm. So residency and fellowship was about like 5-6 years. So while I was at Cornell building my lab and working, and I actually had moved into more like administrative position towards the end, but he was still making his way up. And then we moved as he had 1 year left for his fellowship. So I came to Korea 2 years ago. He came 1 year ago.
Okay.
So I moved to Korea with two kids as a single mom.
So that was in 2022?
Yes.
Or like the fall or something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
You returned?
Yes.
So let's talk about that. Why? I mean, was that always the plan once you and Dan were together and had a family?
No.
So for a while, you thought we might just stay in the U.S.?
Yeah. I mean, by the time that we moved here, it was 15 years. I talked about 15 years of being in the U.S. with you from, you know, PhD program till the end of my job at Cornell. For about 10 years or 13 years, we lived like graduate students and medical students. We were hopping around and, you know, lived on IKEA furniture.
Yeah.
And then we finally bought our house in New York in like the perfect neighborhood. It was like American dream come true, right? From the girl who moved to America from Seoul. So we were like, oh my gosh, we're finally getting settled. I have a real job. Dan's about to get a real job and it'll be amazing. And then we slowly are learning that my mom has early onset dementia, that she's declining. And we were like, oh my gosh, should we move? But we have this amazing life here. So we were debating. And also at the same time, my kids were growing up.
Yeah.
And like, I didn't feel like this every day, but sometimes I felt like they were becoming strangers to me.
Yeah. Can we ask about that? Because this happens a lot, right? So your kids are born in the U.S.
Yes.
They're American citizens.
Yes.
They're growing up as Americans.
Yes.
And that's what you mean by strangers.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I will be like listening to music, driving with them. And then like some memories are coming with like these feelings with the Korean songs. And I will talk about it and my kids will be like, huh? Yeah. And when I like eat something, I'm talking about all the memories from Korea and they're like, what? And they're not super interested in either. I mean, some say it's generational gap, but like, so I told my husband, Dan, I was like, they need to be in the culture where we grew up in. So all these discussions are happening, and then I talk to my friend in Korea about maybe I am thinking about moving, and she happens to know people here at Korea University, so they reach out to me and they're like, oh, they we did. Heard uh-huh. that you might be moving and we have a great job. And I was like, okay, maybe this is a good opportunity. So I did interview and then got an offer right away. It was so fast. And meanwhile, Dan's like, it is the right thing to do for us to go and be with our families. His parents are here. My parents are here.
Yeah.
My mom's declining. And it, looking back, it was probably not the smartest decision career-wise, but it was the right thing to do, so we moved.
Right. So, so okay, let's pretend that it isn't the best move for your career. I don't know. But what it's the best for is for your life, your personal life, your family, and your sense of I want to ask this one thing. It's a really tough question. So you look at your kids and you go, they're growing up. It might be generational, but they're growing up differently than I did. They don't have any understanding of these Korean foods, this music, these experiences that I had. And you thought, we need to get them around that culture. But why? Like, why, if they had just stayed and become Korean Americans, would that have been okay?
Yes. That would have been totally okay, I think.
But it's like they would have been fine with it because that's all they know. But you would have been like, there's this other part of our history.
Yes, that they don't know. Yeah. It was more for me, I think. But when we moved, we found out that my dad had cancer. So he had bladder cancer, so he did chemo, didn't go away, so he did surgery. And during the time, I am taking care of my kids, I'm taking care of my parents, I'm building up my new lab. I've never taught before, so I'm teaching. So a lot of things were going on. It was very hard.
And Dan's not here.
Dan's not here. I was with Dan's parents, though, so they were amazing. Yeah. They were looking after the kids. But one thing that I really appreciate is that the kids were thriving.
Huh.
They were doing so amazingly that I was able to attend to other things. David came, and I put him in Korean school. He's now 10. He was 8 at the time. He really couldn't keep up in Korean school because his Korean was really bad.
Yeah.
So we moved him to international school here, and he was very happy, but he still spends a lot of time with his grandparents. And we actually have 4 generations in our house now. It's Dan's grandma, Dan's parents, Dan, and kids. Our kids. So 4 generations living in one house.
I love it.
Together.
Yeah.
And they get exposed to so many things that they've never experienced before. And Grace, who's 6 now, who was 4 at the time, I put her in Korean school. She couldn't say a word in Korean. Now she cannot speak English.
Mm.
She only speaks Korean.
Wow.
She converted into a total Korean girl. During this transition, the kids were doing so well that was like the one thing that I really just appreciated.
It feels like you were almost worried. Like, is this going to be bad for the kids? In the end, it's not. They're doing great.
Yes, they are the ones who are, I think, benefiting the most from this move, and they're very spoiled now by grandparents.
Well, I mean, there are worse things than that, for sure. Let's talk about KU, right? So I know you're teaching, you told me this, I think you told me it's more than a year ago, you're teaching a neurodiversity class here, right?
Yeah, I am.
And I wondered, like, if you think about the long arc of autism and its recognition both, like, biologically and just as a social condition and how much that has changed in the U.S. and Europe and stuff. And I'm assuming that Korea's, like, on a similar path of recognition of the condition.
Just starting.
Yeah, it's just behind the curve a little bit, right?
Yeah, but it'll be similar trend, yes.
So what are you teaching in the classes?
Neurodiversity class? It's mostly really 101 autism, because knowing it accurately, I think, changes their attitude about people with the disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And the knowledge is very limited too. So there's a lot about behavior presentations, how heterogeneous it is throughout the life, the presentation change too, and what are the treatment options, and how does neurodiversity play into this clinical practice as well as research. So every session, every class, we have some neurodiversity perspective integrated into like Autism 101. And then towards the end, we talk about community-based participatory research. Mm-hmm. We talk about like women with autism.
This underrepresented
group. Yeah. We talk about workplace and autism. So it's more like applied. But in the beginning, there's heavy emphasis on like just knowing
what it
getting
is.
Knowledge.
Yeah, because it feels like this is still happening in the U.S., of course, but like when people used to see an autistic child, they go, I don't know, something's wrong with that child. And when you actually know what it is, like, that's just an autistic person, that's the way they are. That's been huge, I think. It's obviously still ongoing, but that's what's happening here too.
Yeah, and I actually treat my class as sort of like intervention, because I feel like I'm informing these kids, and I teach 160 students every semester.
And these are undergrads?
Yes.
These are
undergrads who've never, some of them have never met a person with autism, who've never heard of autism.
Well, they probably did. They just didn't know it was autism.
Yeah, that's true. But at the same time, these are the students who were the best at studying in the entire country, and they were always in a very competitive classrooms where by the time that you get to middle school, high school, you don't see a lot of students with disabilities in your class
because
anymore.
I got it. Yeah.
But at the same time, there probably were some high functioning students who were never identified.
That makes sense. Okay. And then you have a lab.
I do have a lab.
Your spectrum child clinical psychology lab. Yeah. So what are you studying there? What are you looking at?
Yeah. So as soon as I came here, I did get a couple grants from the National Research Foundation in Korea. And I am extending some of the studies that I had done at Cornell. And then I am finishing up some of the R01 studies that I had to carry here. One thing that we are doing now is longitudinal study following kids over time, looking at some school readiness. So we're looking at executive function, language, social communication, and how that changes during the school transition. And we use like EEG methods as well as behavior methods to follow these kids. And we got the grant last year, and we started data collection in August, September last year. It's been almost a year. We had 700 families calling us to participate, and we saw about 200 kids so far. And I had 3 or 4 people doing assessments, and I went to almost every assessment, I think, because I was still training them.
Yeah.
And I met most of these families. That has been the most amazing experience since I came here, because I've never met families with autistic kids in Korea until now. Like, I had a lot of clinical experiences in the US, but not here. So just working with the families, I was just calling with the family in the morning before you came here too, giving a diagnosis, basically delivering the news. But that has been an amazing experience.
So two things. Well, first, how was that news taken? How did the families react?
Most of the time, parents are, I think, have mixed feelings. So I think it's similar to the U.S., but they worry. They worry quite a bit, because then what's next is a big question. But in Korea, a lot of kids are not identified until they are probably 6, 7, 8 years. Because first of all, even though you have an early diagnosis, the government would give you vouchers, but it wouldn't give you enough services. So you actually just pay for services anyway, and you don't need a diagnosis to do that. Mm-hmm. So families will recognize some delays in kids, and they will bring them to like private centers. They get services, and then they hope that kids will get better, right, with the intervention. And then once they realize that the trajectories are going to be lifelong, they may get a diagnosis. Mm. And also the wait time for diagnostic assessment is 2 to 3 years now
in
Korea. So when we said you can get the ADOS, which is the diagnostic measure, through research for free, like in a month, 700 families call.
I was going to say, so that showed you that there's a real need.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, not only have you done all these great things for your family, but this is a needful population that you can help service.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. So you're happy with KU. You're happy with this switch.
Yes, yeah. Another thing that's rewarding is teaching and also having students who are Korean. I feel like I can, you know, give back and really, you know, be part of building up this next generation of researchers and clinicians in this area.
Yeah. So a couple things. One is let's talk about just living abroad for a second, like we were talking about before. You know, like I said, so I'm going to be here 10 days, and I spent 2 days like figuring out my T-Money card and how the subways work, and okay, now can I figure out the buses and all these things. And like when you go to a foreign country, you know, that's a long day of like a language wall and figuring it out. Now, you had English when you moved to the U.S., but still, right? So, but that goes on day after day.
Yes.
You, like, how do I get you have to get a driver's license. You have to get a car in Michigan if you're going to be, right?
Yes. So
how did you do all of those things? And I'm not sure Dan had same kind of feelings, right? It's exhausting to live like that.
Yes, yeah, it is. And it's not like you have parents who've done it so that you can call them and say, what happens if I get into a car accident, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And every milestone, like having a child, you have to go register him, and like all these like, you know, different kinds of administrative things that you have to do too. There's like no one to ask. So you Google, right? Or, I mean, it's huge. You know, sometimes these little stressors can be, I think, hard to manage.
Yeah.
And I don't think that I could have done it without the little social network that I had. So Dan was there, right?
Yeah.
And then I was part of a church community in Ann Arbor.
Oh yeah.
And then when I moved to Connecticut too, I was there with a church community.
What
always
church?
First generation Koreans.
Oh, really? That's
yes.
the church?
Yeah. Those are the churches that we went to.
What's the faith?
It's the Christianity.
Yeah.
First
generation.
Presbyterian
Christian, first generation Koreans.
And I also cannot fit into like a second generation church either. So it was always first 1.5 generation churches.
And so in those places, you found everyone just like you.
Yes. Everyone just like me. In Ann Arbor, all of my friends were PhD students who were Koreans, who grew up in Korea, who went to college in Korea and came to Ann Arbor for PhD programs.
Yeah.
But in church, there were other people who actually immigrated to Ann Arbor from, or they stay there after their PhD, basically.
Yeah.
But I had a lot of support from them. When I was in Connecticut, I had a lot of social network. Like I remember going to INSAR 1 year, it was Netherlands, and I had Grace, and she was like 3 months or 4 months. I was like, how am I gonna travel with a 3-month-old? My friend from church came with me, and she took care of the girl, Grace, while I was giving a talk. Like,
amazing.
Instead of bringing parent, right?
Yeah.
My friend from church came and that's how we survived.
Are you still, you're still in touch with those
people? Yeah, I am still in touch with them.
Like, and when you go back to New York, maybe, do you see them at all?
Actually, many of them came to Korea.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so they came back to Seoul. So I talk to them quite often. I meet with them.
Oh, they moved back?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, many of them got jobs here.
I mean, I don't know that this is the case, but it seems to me from some of the limited reading that I've done that there's a lot of people who are returning to Seoul.
Yes.
In the past, like, 20 years. The city is booming, the economy is booming, and they're like, I'm going to go.
Yeah.
And everything's changed.
Yep. Yeah. I think I am quite surprised at the government putting funds for R&D. I mean, there was a budget cut, as you know, but still... I think the government is still quite invested in science.
Yeah, yeah.
It's harder for people in, you know, who are not in like basic science, but still, I think we have good system.
Yeah.
Set up.
Do you consider that your children might want to go abroad?
Yes, especially David. And Grace, probably, because she's moving to international school, too. So the reason why I am moving Grace to international school, even though she's doing really well in Korean school, is because I, as a parent, cannot deal with this academic pressure. So if I want her to, you know, follow this path of, you know, studying,
education,
studying until you get to, like, the best college ever... in Korea, I had to be that mom who's always searching for the best tutors, best training, because everyone goes to Hagwon, which is the institute's after school, and they stay there until 10 p.m. because legally they have to close at 10 p.m. If there's no law like that, it's gonna go until 2 a.m.
Oh my God.
I promise. So 10 p.m. they go and get classes, you know, study, and then they go to, like, a, you know, study hall or something and start studying again. I remember coming home at 2 a.m. every day during my high school years. That was like 20 years ago. I don't know. But now kids are studying more.
You were doing that too 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh my.
Yeah. So I cannot be the mom who is always designing my kids' life like that. And I just cannot keep up. So I said, they will go to international school. I wouldn't worry about all these crazy pressure. Of course, in international school, there are lots of Korean moms who do this. But still, they have options of, you know, just being kids. So even though it's super expensive, we will try to keep both kids in international school, meaning they cannot go to colleges in Korea.
Oh, you're not allowed to.
Unless you take that SAT, Korean SAT, but that's going to be impossible. I mean, they don't speak English, I mean, Korean as well. And think about all these students who are building up to take that test for 10, 12 years, going to these training, tutoring institutes.
Yeah. So they're almost now, if they continue in this life, they're almost like forced to go to college abroad.
Yes, yeah.
So they're going to go to college abroad.
Which David doesn't know yet. David's like, Mom, I want to go to college here in Korea and hang out with you guys. And I was like, sure. But he will have to go to college in outside of Korea.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that's the U.S. or it could be anywhere?
Anywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anywhere. And why not, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they're American citizen, but, you know, they can go anywhere. And but I think... for them to go to college in America or other places after growing up in Korea is a very different life than growing up in the U.S. and going to college there.
Yeah.
'Cause by the time that I went to the U.S., I had my identity as Korean. It was core to me, and I think that was really important for me. So, you know, they will have that kind of identity here, just growing up. I mean, it'll be different because they were born in the U.S.,
yeah.
But still. Yeah. Korea will be always part of their heart. Yeah.
I think, one more question, and it actually deals with identity, like you just mentioned. So I was introduced to you, or I knew you as Sophie.
Yeah.
But of course, that's not your name.
Yeah. Yeah?
Your name is So-hyun Kim.
Which, yes. Yeah. Good.
Well, that's not. So why did you? There's a long history, of course, of people immigrating and changing names, shortening their names, taking on names to sound more like, you know, the local population. Why did you do that? And
I regretted it.
Go ahead. Yeah.
The other office.
Uh-huh.
So they will pick it up if I don't pick up. What was the question?
So, you know, Sophie, taking the name Sophie. Yeah.
Yeah.
You said you regretted it.
Yeah. So I do regret it. So my dad, so Kim So-hyun is how you say my name. Kim is the family name. So-hyun is my first name. Even though in Korea, first name goes last.
Yeah.
My dad named me, and like in high school, I was going to English classes. I needed an English name. So my dad was like, what about Sophie? Because it, you know, So-hyun, Sophie, similar. So I was like, sure, it was my nickname in English classes.
Yeah.
And then I went to America, and people just had such a hard time pronouncing my name and remembering it. I remember running in. I did like 10K, which was a big deal for me.
Yeah.
Took me like 3 hours or something. I don't remember. After then, I never ran. I remember like running. And then towards the end, at the finish line, everyone's like cheering. And there's a guy who's emceeing the event and saying, Brady made it.
Yeah.
Yay. Dan made it. Yay. And then I come in and he never says He doesn't say anything because he's afraid of
making a mistake.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it was like that. Like people were just afraid of saying my name. So I was like, sure, I will use my nickname. And I went by Sophie. But the problem was that I will publish in my real name, So-hyun Kim. And people will never make connections between me and that name. So I think that's one of the troubles that I have about, like, when people meet me and get to know me, they're like, oh, you are Sophie. You are So-hyun Kim in this paper. So, like, you know, getting my name out there was important at some point throughout my academic career, but that was one of the barriers that I had. And I always wondered when I got like corrected for my English in my manuscript, even though I had 17 other, you know, native speakers on as co-authors, I always like wondered in the back of my mind, had like, oh, is it because of my name?
Uh-huh.
So that's
because of the So-hyun Kim.
Yes.
Yeah.
If it's like very foreign, right?
Yeah. So they're gonna think that you've made a mistake for that reason. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So actually, this is my last question then. When I put this out.
Oh, yeah.
Can I just say So-hyun Kim? Can it be that? Or do you want it to be Sophie?
So what I usually do is I put my name So-hyun, and then in quotation, I put Sophie. So it'll be So-hyun Sophie Kim.
That's you want to do?
Yes. That's how I usually do. But I mean, it's up to you.
It feels like... I don't know. It just feels wrong.
I know. But like, I doubt that even my close colleagues in the U.S., I doubt that they remember my legal name.
Really?
I mean, like, people like Kathy, definitely, like,
she knows.
You know, she knows. Yeah. And like, there are so many siblings under Kathy, my sisters, like Summer Bishop, Vanessa Bell, they all my real names, but like others, I don't know. Even if I worked with them, I'm not really 100% sure if they know my real name or not.
Okay. We're gonna think about this. We're gonna think about this. Okay. That's it. Thank you so much.
Oh, yay. Yeah. We did it.
I mean, unless you have something else to add.
No.
We're good. All right, we're good. Thank you. Boy, did I learn a lot in that interview. I really did. When we were done, Sohyung took me around the campus. It's gorgeous. And then drove me to an art museum where we saw some work by well-known Korean artists of the past and some modern works too. So that was a great day. Thank you, Sohyung, for the open conversation and your hospitality in your home country. Okay, this episode will be archived on thetransmitter.org, where we also have a transcript. We have put links into the transcript for any papers that we discussed if you're interested in more information. Some of the details for the intro on Seoul and Korea were taken from the Korea Herald. And of course, there is a Synaptic episode with Kathy Lord in our archives. That's episode one. Our very first Synaptic was with Kathy. If you'd like to comment on this show or whatever we do with the Transmitter, you can find us on the social media platforms X, Blue Sky, Mastodon, and LinkedIn. Our theme song was written and performed by Chris Collinwood. Thank you for listening to Synaptic. Until next time.
I was also losing my voice yesterday, so I got nervous. It's podcast. I was talking to Dan, my husband.